KCQA Anahola.
We're not doctors, lawyers, or professional counselors or therapists. Please call those folks directly. This show is meant to get us all comfortable with thinking about our deaths, with thinking about a plan for our loved ones after we've departed, and an idea of what we believe. In doing so, we're forced to look upon our lives. When we do this, we leave with a little more thankfulness, a little more love for ourselves, our lives, our loved ones, and what we've accomplished so far in this short period on Earth.
Aloha! Welcome Hello. To the Kauai Death Cafe!
Hi.
How are you today, Susan?
As they say, I'm alive.
We are alive.
What else?
Well, we thought we would talk about...
What to do if you're still alive.
That's right. Going forward.
Going forward.
Going forward. What to do if you're lucky enough to still be alive. In the face of bad news.
Yeah.
You know? How do you cope with things? How do you, you know?
Move forward.
Move forward. And not just with bad news, but I mean on a daily basis too, right?
Yeah, because bad news looms everywhere.
Because maybe it's not your bad news, you know? I mean, even just the status of the world right now, bad news, you know?
Yeah.
Watching TV, bad news kind of things, or...
Or the reality of life on this planet. It's up and down.
Yeah.
Good news, bad news.
Yeah, and you could really paint a pretty negative picture of it for yourself if you wanted to.
But we're here to give you a positive view.
We're a bunch of Debbie Uppers instead of Debbie Downers. Maybe. We weren't Debbie Uppers last weekend when we had our discussion about dementia. So we decided that this show would be more uplifting. So what you can expect out of us today is some uplifting music, some uplifting sound bites, from discussions from some of our favorite motivators, Alan Watts and the likes, and I don't know, some uplifting discussion. So, you had an interesting week.
Or if not uplifting, at least realistic. I'm sort of more in the realistic side of it than the uplifting, but... That's a minor distinction.
No, you know what? You're right. Because you could probably poo-poo anything. Somebody could say, that wasn't uplifting.
Right.
We Are the World's the saddest song I ever heard. It could be.
Yeah.
It could be. Yeah. Well, without further ado... Well, actually, I wanted to talk about kind of... So I had this interesting thing happen to me this week. I work with an attorney sometimes for estate planning purposes. And sometimes our relationship takes a turn where he calls me because he has a situation where he's been with someone who's in grief or who has had something that's very tragic happen to them. And then he's having to sort of step outside of his role as an attorney and into this sort of different role that shows a lot of compassion, and it's not very normal for him. So this weekend he was called to the hospital, and it was for a friend of his family's, for their daughter, and she had had some type of sepsis, and it resulted in them amputating both of her feet, one of her hands, and half of her other hand.
Phew.
And they were going there to do some medical power of attorney things, and she was actually in a rehab center by this point, so she'd gone through the difficulty of, you know, being in septic shock, waking up from a surgery with no arms and legs, you know, and moving forward. So now she's at a rehab center and sort of trying to get some things in place. And he said that he just felt compelled to stay there with her afterwards because he just wanted to get to know her better. You know, And in talking to her, he learned that she had gone on the Camino Real, the Sangre, what's it called? Camino Santiago.
not sure, but that trail. That huge trail
in Spain that goes to all the different missions, you know, and one of her treks was over 500 miles long.
Wow.
And, you know, the nature of going on that adventure was that she meets people along the way, you know, and you hike with them for a while, and then maybe they go somewhere else. And her whole trek, she kind of wondered who she was going to be with at the end and who was going to make it there with her, kind of thing. She did make it all the way. She made it the whole 500 miles from where she had started. Because you can start in France, you can start in Spain. There's all these hopping off points, right? And she got there at the end, and she was there alone. And she was there in the big chapel, you know, there alone, quote unquote, with God, you know, just her and God. And, you know, and that's where we all arrive at the end of things.
The journey, yeah.
Is you arrive there alone. So she told him this whole story. And she said, you know, and I didn't just do it once, I did it twice. But the second trek wasn't 500 miles, it was a little shorter than that. And then she said, and I'm going to do it again.
Phew.
And she said she was going to get this license plate for the back of her wheelchair.
Oh my God, I'm going to cry too.
You know, and it was going to say, you know, like her name in abbreviation and like NXCHPTR, like next chapter.
Phew.
And she was saying this story from a rehab center.
Where she lost limbs.
They had to tape with gauze and tape a pen to her hand to be able to sign these documents. She'd, you know, yet to have any control over any of that stuff because she'd just been released from the hospital.
Wow.
So the first time she ever signed her name was on these documents, you know. But it was just, what do you do? You know, and that's what she thought to do. And so I was, the reason that it joys me is because it makes me realize that a lot of people, when they're faced with adversity, they become an exaggerated version of themselves. You know, and so she did that thing twice. Well, now she's going to do it in an exaggerated version of herself in a wheelchair with all the glory of you know, of herself. And so her perseverance has really been amplified.
Wow.
And moving through that, you know. And I just think it's great. I just think it's a tear-jerkingly sad story, but at the same time, it's just an amazing story.
And how it ties in with my experience this week, where I was wandering, I was walking the bay in my normal walk and came to Black Pot, and there were a bunch of the CORE people I belong to. I help out at something called CORE, which is the Kauai Outdoor Recreational Experience, where once a month they take people out who are unable to get in the water by themselves, and they have all this equipment and so many volunteers, firemen and policemen and surfers who take these people out in the water and give them, you know, an experience of a lifetime when you can't do that on your own anymore. And some of them have been avid surfers and just can't go out anymore. So anyway, I'm walking by and I see my friends, my CORE friends, and they're taking out a group of amputees. And so I stopped to talk to one of my friends, Cheryl, and asked her what was going on. And she told me, there is a woman, she's a doctor from the East Coast, who for 20 years has worked with people who were just getting out of surgery from having a limb removed. Mm-hmm. And she's their doctor. And so she, for 20 years, has carried this grief with these people. And plus had a husband who was sick for 10 years, and she took care of him. And it turns out that when he died and left her a bunch of money, what she did is started a foundation which takes out amputees, takes amputees from all over the country, all over the world, like to Switzerland. And this is the first time they've come to Hanalei. And she was treated with such aloha that she wants to come back here all the time, and she's arranging that. But anyway, these amputees were some of the most heartfelt, amazing humans I think I've ever met. The joy, the kind of, I don't even have the word, being around them for me was so uplifting, so heartlifting to see people who have, and this particular group were all vets, so they'd lost limbs in unimaginable circumstances, mm-hmm. and their spirits and their joy and their support of each other was, it was life-changing. It was literally life-changing for me this week, because a lot of my old concepts, especially about vets, were totally demolished. And I was just honored to know this woman and to know these people, even for just a day. So anyway, that's another story of people's perseverance and ability to overcome. And
yeah. And the story of the woman, you know, lifting them up to do it and to feel good. And
yeah, and what she said, which really touched me the most, is she just wanted them to experience joy. Mm. It wasn't about healing. It wasn't about fixing. It was about joy. And those people were so joyful, being, as we all, I'm sure everyone listening to the show knows, that Hanalei Bay is an uplifter. And so they got to play in the bay with some of our finest firemen and police people that just dedicate their time to situations like this. This was an uplifting week, at least for me and that woman.
Yeah.
So.
And all those people.
All those people. Yeah. They're all coming back. They were treated with the real aloha. They couldn't believe how they were treated. They were, but we know Kauai, and it can love you. If it loves you, it will love you up.
It will. Or it'll love you right out. We're going to take a tiny break and actually have an ocean safety.
Your goal is not to stop it. Your goal is to get to know it.
To get to know it.
Yeah.
But everything in our body, when something bad happens, it says, let's run away.
That's right. So instead of running away, you touch in, tune in. Drop the storyline and just experience the disappointment, you know. And you stay with that. What happens is you escalate it with your storyline, and then it turns into rage.
But that doesn't make the storyline incorrect. The storyline may be true. I mean, there are things in the world that do need to be fought against and changed.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. So if you would like to be an effective person for change, it's not going to happen if you're coming out of being all worked up and heated up and righteously indignant.
You know, it's a curious thing that human beings seem to take everything so terribly.
So that was a little clip of Pema.
Children.
I don't ever know how to pronounce her last name. Children.
Yeah. Emma Children.
That's one of Susan's very favorite people.
Right now. I've gone through many. But actually, I listened to Pema back in the 80s. I was living in Ashland, Oregon, and somehow or other, the Tibetan Buddhists wound up there. Yeah. And all of those teachings kind of permeated Ashland, Oregon. And so they were very interesting. I guess, like, I've followed a lot of teachings, including getting baptized in Hanalei Bay. So it's not, you know, I'm not a Tibetan Buddhist. But I listened to her in the 80s. I hadn't listened to her since then. When I did my psilocybin experience on my 80th birthday, a friend came and told me to read the Tibetan Book of the Dead again, which sounded like a good idea because I was virtually at the end of life during that experience. And from there, because audiobooks always say, and since you like this book, you might like this.
Oh, right.
So it put Pema on my screen again, and I started listening to her. And I mean, talk about listening to a big sister and guiding me in a lot of a She gave a lot of suggestions and mantras and meditations to guide us through the uncertainty of life and the sadness of life and our inability to change any of it. And so since then, I've been listening to her religiously, you know, and being reminded that everything's impermanent, there's nothing we can do, and we're going to die. So for me, at this moment in life, it's been a great comfort to have her on my audiobooks.
That's so nice. I was reading about her, and she was one of the... Is she the only woman that's an ordained
Buddhist nun? I don't know if she's the only one, but she was ordained. And again, she was ordained. She became one because of the dark, really sad, grievous things that happened to her. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a way around that. Yeah. You know, just like those people I met, those vets that I met this week who were partially who they were because of great grief and sadness. So, you know, it's sort of like telling the truth instead of we should play the hope thing from Jenkinson, you know, instead of hoping and praying, which is, I'm not discounting, but there's also making peace with the reality of life on the planet Earth.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's...
Sometimes hope can't override truth.
Right.
You know.
Or the reality.
And the reality of that truth.
And Pema has been reality for me. It's like, all that's fine, but you are going to die, and everybody suffers.
Yes.
That's like what I have to keep reminding myself. Everybody suffers.
We're so not getting out of it without suffering.
Yeah, everybody.
Or witnessing suffering. We had a little discussion with somebody about that today. You know, their mom has cancer and he's having to witness that suffering, you know, or bracing himself to witness that as it gets towards the end.
Which is his suffering.
Which will then in turn be him suffering, you know, and then...
Or even now suffering for someone else's suffering.
Yep.
Which I'm very good at.
Well, and, you know, the suffering of the world.
Yes. We are the world.
We are the world. So I think we're going to play We Are the World now. And when we come back, we're going to have a clip from Stephen Jenkinson. So enjoy.
Talk about hope. And, you know, hope is one of the it seems like it's one of the bedrock values in Western culture. And many psychologists speak about how important hope is for one's health and well-being.
Sure.
And, you know, it seems like you have a slightly different outlook on hope. So how do you see or understand hope?
You know, our entire talk could have been devoted to this one thing. That's how vast it is. So I have to do it very much on the short. But the gist of it is this, you know, it's clear that, you know, I'm on the record now as officially declaring that being hopeful and being hopeless are not two opposites. They're twins. They're very close. Okay. What's the point? My point is both of them depend on hope. Hopeful depends on hope, obviously. But hopeless depends on hope too, just as much. In order to be hopeless, you got to have experimented with hope and found it a failure. See what I'm saying? It still has to be there. So I have an alternative, such as it is. I'm not much of a program guy, but for, you know, at the risk of sounding like I have one in this case, my idea is hope-free, which is not a portion of either one of those two. It just opts out. It says, look, man, I tried being hopeful. It was interesting. It had its moments, you know, but God almighty, it was doomed much more often than not. Okay. So then I tried hopeless. Nobody ever says it that way, but let's say it that way. I tried hopeless, tried it on, fit pretty good, especially after hope didn't work out. The natural thing to do seemed like the responsible thing to do. Seemed like I knew finally what I was doing when I was hopeless. Yeah. Except There's some about hopeless that kept, like it was a, it was like the spin cycle that never ended. You know, it didn't turn into anything. Hopeless begets hopeless. That's how it goes. Hopeless seeks out hopeless, right? You make a support group called Hopeless. And that's what you trade in every Monday night or whatever it is. So how about this? I tried hopeful. I tried hopeless. They each had their compulsions and their attractions and their uses. That's true. But it was a con, because the idea was everything is either one of those or the other of those. Everything can be understood as either the presence of one of them or the absence of the other. Hope free, on the other hand, hope free says, man, I tried them both. I gave them a fair shot, you know? And something occurred to me that I didn't require hope in order to proceed. I know that's the party line, that you gotta have hope and then people won't finish the sentence. So I would often ask them, you gotta have hope for what? Or you gotta be hopeful. I said, no, finish the sentence. That is a finished sentence from the point of view of being hopeful, isn't it? It has its own reasons, doesn't it? It just works, doesn't it? It's like a sharp-dressed man. It just works. You don't have to elaborate as to why. No, you should. You should try. You got to be hopeful, or else what? Or else you'd be hopeless. Baby, if you are a hopeful person, you will be hopeless sooner or later. Isn't that how it goes? You know that's how it goes. And you go back and forth between them, and you call that progress. It's Donkey Kong or whatever. What was that old freaking crazy video game, the early one? Whatever it was. That's what that is. Okay. So I'm saying this. You know, we're in an insanely troubled time. I mean, you can barely keep your wits about you. You pay attention to any kind of news feed, you go out of your mind. So now you look for all kinds of distractions as an antidote to the news feed, and now you go out of your mind, and so on and so on. Okay, so you got to stay hopeful. Really? To do what? What's being hopeful doing for you now? It's a crazy time. It's not an antidote to the crazy time. If you're a real citizen, which is what I'm pleading for now, not an opt-out specialist, a citizen now, that means you're in, right? That means we can count on you for the heavy lifting. Do you got to be hopeful to be a citizen of a troubled time? It sounds like you do until you start wondering about that got to part. Can you do the heavy lifting without hope? Not hopeless, hope free. Can you do the work and not ask to be paid first? Because that's what hope is. Hope says, I got to feel positive about the outcome, or I'm not going to work on behalf of the outcome. That's hope. It doesn't sound hopeful. But that's how hope actually works. Got to be hopeful first. Got to have the upside in view, right? Got to be positive. But wait, we're in the shit. What do you mean we got to be positive? I'm positive we're in the shit. Is that what you mean? No. Positive is an alternative to being in the shit. No, it isn't. It's truancy, right? So how do you occupy your God, if I can use the phrase, your God-given place in the shit? Because we're in it.
How do you actually die from Parkinson's? And how is...
Well, that just stopped in the middle and changed. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to find the rest of it. Hold on one second. It's a technical. Sorry for the dead air there.
Oh, nice music. Sounds like church.
Let's see here. Oh, it just ate my playlist and I can't find it. We'll be right back.
I'd like to talk about.
I'm going to work on behalf of the outcome.
Here we go.
That's hope. It doesn't sound hopeful, but that's how hope actually works. Got to be hopeful first. Got to have the upside in view, right? Got to be positive. But wait, we're in the shit. What do you mean we got to be positive? I'm positive if life could possibly be in a time like this. You don't need hope to get your bearings. What you need is a willingness to occupy the fact that you were born to a troubled time. You see, maybe that's not an accident. Maybe that's not what your generation call a random. You know, one of the favorite words I keep hearing, random, is like, maybe it's not random that you were born to a troubled time. And maybe it's not punishment either for bad karma. Maybe being born to a troubled time means that the troubles of your times needed the likes of you. Maybe that's what it means. Maybe the troubles of the times stand a chance of being ameliorated because the likes of you were born to them. And if you're willing to take up the citizen's work, maybe the troubles of your times, maybe they take a little bit of a hit for a change. See, that's the plea I make. I'm saying this to you, and I feel a lump in my throat to say it, okay? Speaking of urgency. But I mean this more deeply than I can say. Maybe being born to a time like this is not affliction for us. Maybe it's an assignment. You can undertake that understanding absolutely free of hope. You don't need it to be able to proceed.
That was Bobby McFerrin, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I used to love that song.
Oh, I think everybody did.
It came out when I was in like the eighth grade. I can remember it.
I mean, talk about positive. That was the most positive song.
That was a fun one. We used to sit in front of the mirror and sing it, me and my friend, and I used to go to the babysitter. It's a long time ago.
It's probably a good thing to sing to yourself in front of the mirror.
Yeah.
Not a bad practice.
No, it's not a bad practice. I wanted to play this TED Talk where this woman talks about how can we change how we respond to bad news. I don't know if we're going to get through the whole thing, but I figured we could start it. So here we go.
A few years ago, my father was diagnosed with advanced cancer, and I almost didn't even hear about it until it was too late. By too late, I mean just 1 week before his surgery. I was incredibly stressed and worried, but told myself that at least this surgery was going to be in one of the most prestigious medical institutions in all of America. I'm not going to tell you the name of the hospital, but you can get the idea. State of the art, the kind of place you're supposed to trust without a second thought. So imagine my shock and confusion when we went to the pre-op appointment with my father to meet the urologist, one of the most senior, by the way, at this medical center. And it became clear pretty quickly that the doctor didn't seem to know very much about my father's very high-risk medical conditions. Here was my dad, about to undergo a lengthy, complex, dangerous procedure. And the doctor didn't seem to know or mention anything about his lifelong history of multiple heart attacks and diagnosis of heart failure, nor did he seem to know anything about his very high bleeding risk. Two pretty important things to know before you're going to cut into someone, no? Instead, the surgeon repeatedly said the cancer looks really advanced, that urgent surgery is his only option, and in his opinion, he didn't think my dad's prognosis or survival looked very good. I was in shock, so was my dad. But we responded to that news in very different ways. My dad went out immediately and made some pretty questionable decisions about his life savings. I know what you're thinking, what kind of questionable decisions? I mean, how bad could they be? Let me put it this way. They were not the kind of decisions he would make if he didn't think the end was near. there were pretty bad decisions. But it was a typical reaction. He did what most people do when they hear some devastating news. They panic, they don't ask questions or consult with others, and they may even accept the fact that they're going to die without putting up a fight. As a medical doctor who's had to be an advocate for a number of family members with cancer and a lot of other life-threatening diagnoses, I have personal experience receiving a shattering diagnosis and delivering them. As a doctor, I've seen patients shut down and go into a state of acceptance or sometimes denial that neither serves their best interests nor prolongs their life. And in fact, studies show that in light of hearing a cancer diagnosis, up to 50% of patients can go into some degree of denial, with men, elderly patients, and those with a different cultural background, people just like my dad, having even higher rates than that. That response is rooted in the way that our brain functions. When we hear any kind of devastating news or when we sense that we're in danger, it's our limbic brain that's activated. The limbic brain is the oldest, most primitive part of our brain, and it governs emotional responses like anger, fear, rage, and sets off our fight or flight responses. It is the limbic brain that tells you not to touch a hot stove or to step back from the edge of the cliff if you're too close. And it's that same exact system that's activated anytime we hear any kind of terrible news. And the problem is when this primitive brain kicks in, it has the ability to diminish and impair our more logical prefrontal cortex, leading us to panic and freeze, and making it more likely for us to make irrational choices. We simply stop thinking logically. I certainly know what that feels like. I moved to the United States when I was just 9 years old. After the trauma of living in a country at war and overcoming the challenges that a young girl from the Middle East deals with growing up in the Midwest, that was as tough as it sounds, my family and I experienced more medical misdiagnoses and treatment errors than anyone should have to go through. I got to a point that it seemed like I was getting negative news pretty frequently, especially bad medical news, and where it seemed like someone in the family was always trying to die on me, especially my dad, on multiple occasions. Later, as I went through my medical training, I learned that when a patient receives a life-threatening diagnosis, effective rapid response is of decisive importance. I know it's not enough to eventually make good decisions when time is of the essence. And it's those very experiences that taught me the importance of asking a lot of questions. So while my dad was out making crazy investments, I decided to do the opposite. I started doing a little bit of digging and asking questions and found another doctor for second medical opinion. Another doctor in that same prestigious medical center. This second doctor was not only kind and compassionate, but very well informed about all of my father's high-risk conditions. And actually, with his help, he was able to refer us to an excellent heart doctor who was able to make some critical medication changes to reduce his risk in preparation for this big surgery. On the day of the surgery, we were all in tears, and we said our goodbyes, thinking that there was probably a pretty high chance that he wouldn't even survive this procedure. The doctors told us that it might be a lengthy procedure, so we kind of prepared ourselves. I was still in tears 15 minutes later when the doctor called me. He was calling to tell me the procedure had ended, and what was thought to be advanced cancer actually turned out to be a benign, non-cancerous growth of insignificant consequence. Can you imagine that? I can't tell you the flood of emotions that came over me at that moment. But in the very least, I was pretty happy that I decided to get the second opinion that led us to this wonderful doctor. And in fact, a study in April of 2021 shows that getting a second medical opinion reduces the chance of misdiagnosis in half, and is one of the most single, most effective steps that can reduce diagnostic errors. Yet, despite this growing body of evidence, a fraction, according to studies, maybe somewhere around 5 to 35% of patients actually seek out a second medical opinion. That's simply the result of patients accepting what they're told in the moment, maybe not wanting to ask too many questions, or maybe being worried what that first doctor is going to think if they seek out a second opinion. That, I think, is a big mistake. We need to do the opposite. When we hear any kind of bad news, encounter the panic of the limbic brain by activating our prefrontal cortex that seeks alternatives, maybe questions authority, and helps us with those higher level decisions. When we do that, we gain ownership of the situation and put ourselves in the driver's seat. I want to leave you with a few steps whenever you hear any kind of bad news. Maybe the news is a cancer diagnosis, maybe it's a financial disaster, maybe it's a divorce. No matter what the news, your response to it and your ability to recover from it are going to be much improved if you gain ownership of the situation. So step one, and this is something we can do now before we hear some kind of terrible news. You have to understand that we have to be mindful of limiting our constant and excessive exposure to negative news, because it can just put us in that vicious limbic loop that puts us in constant survival mode. I know that's been really difficult to do the last few years, but we have to do it to protect our mental health. Instead, by surrounding ourselves with supportive family and friends, hopefully ones that can get us out of that limbic hijack, or considering practicing gratitude or mind-body skills, we can really train and prepare our nervous system and our prefrontal cortex have much healthier responses when that